The Presentation Podcast, Season 7, Episode 181. We continue the conversation around TED Talks. This time joined by Jacqueline Farrington, a former TEDx senior speaker coach and author of the just-released and already award-winning book Better Presentations, How to Present Like a Pro, Virtually or in Person. Let's join Troy, Sandy, and Nolan for a conversation that is like a TED Talk, full of ideas worth spreading.
Hi, I'm Troy from TLC Creative Services, based in Southern California.
Welcome to the Presentation Podcast. I'm Sandy Johnson with Presentation Wiz in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And I'm Nolan Hames from Nolan Hames Creative in Montclair, New Jersey.
Okay, so on the news front, there's some industry stuff happening before we jump into our awesome conversation. And I got to start off with, So I discovered something a bit after the fact, or at least after our last conversation about TED Talks. Not all TEDx talks are found on the TED.com site. Hmm. Some are basically the really high or the high view ones. The full library, and I'll put a link in the show notes, is found. I mean, you basically have to, if you're on TED.com, you have to go several navigation clicks down to where it takes you to YouTube, where there is a TEDx Talks branded section, and it has 202,000 videos in it. So they're using YouTube as the repository for all the TEDx affiliate. And then the higher level ones, or the ones that have more views, they move into TED.com. I just had this discovery. I know we had worked with a TEDx presenter, Jacob Green, and I was like kind of baffled in our last conversation with, why can't I find it? I know Lori worked with this person for like 2 months on their presentation. I found it there. Yeah. So anyways, good, just a little side note.
Okay. Well, one more TED bit of information. We mentioned that the original TED Talks had expanded into affiliate programs like TEDx. Well, there are more TED events than we realized. Listen to this list. There's TEDx. There's TED-Ed. There's TED Fellows, TED Institute, TED at Work, TEDx Youth, TED-Ed Español, and another program called The Audacious Project. I didn't realize that was TED focused. And TED Translator. Excuse me. And TED Translators, which is really cool. These are TED Talks made by 10 TED translators that are volunteers who subtitle TED Talks into other languages. The stats are 115 languages, over 47,000 translators, and over 200,000 translated videos. We're going to add the link in the notes. Just a tidbit, an update.
That's a lot of things to coordinate. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Presentation software news, Google Slides, remember that? Finally added annotation to slideshows. Welcome to 2023. You can now annotate and draw in your Google Slideshow if you're using Google Slides. I know a lot of people do. It's good. It's good. Still, not as full featured, but they keep adding features which are being asked for and begged for. So that's a good one. And that'll definitely help.
Well, then PowerPoint powers ahead by helping you stay organized with adding tasks in PowerPoint notes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they mean notes. I think it's comments in PowerPoint comments.
It is. It's comments. The feature is so cool, but again, it's Microsoft naming. This is the new version or the updated version of PowerPoint comments, but they're now calling them tasks. But they're still labeled as comments when you go into PowerPoint. No, it's like a task list within the comment. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's cool.
It is. What it is you you can still tag somebody in the comment, and this is only for the web, tag somebody with the traditional @Troy @Nolan. But then there's a little checkbox in your comment that says assign to so-and-so. And you would use the tagging feature for that.
I think it's cool. I just had I did get the link you sent, and I looked at it. I'm like, wait a minute, these are comments. Like, oh, it's a feature within comments now, or expanded use.
Mm-hmm. It's only for the web right now.
Yes, but I didn't thoroughly. I'm going to say this without 100% positivity. If you do it on the web and you open it up on the desktop, they're still listed there. They're still available.
Okay.
You know what?
I did actually check one to see if it works.
I don't have it at all. So this is why I may sound a little bit confused, but it does say in the article that it's, you can do it in PowerPoint for Windows, PowerPoint for Mac, and PowerPoint for the web.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And again, I was testing it on my Surface computer, which I'm running the beta version. So I you know, it gets things ahead of time. Okay, one last item before we move on. This one's actually a great tie-in because there's a new study from Carmen Simon, and the study is entitled, Do Zoom Backgrounds Help or Hinder Sales Presentations? I think this applies to any time you're presenting in Zoom. I will include the link. It's a PDF. It's a really quick read. It's very a good read. I'll just give you the summary. Use a real background. Don't use a fake background. You're not at the beach presenting. You're not in New York. You're sitting in San Diego, whatever it is, which is really interesting because our guest today and the book that was that they wrote has a whole section and they say the exact same thing. So very aligned on our backgrounds. And I just have a thing about green screen because if you're at your home, you don't have the appropriate lighting for green screen to work effectively and you end up with some visual tearing, some blips, if you wear glasses, you know, there's just so many technical reasons that I've been saying this since 2020 when everybody started doing it. I was like, you know, this isn't really your best help, but you know, it's mandated. So let's try and make it work. Could you move that light over here? Oh my gosh. Anyways, so new study out and anything that Dr. Simon puts out is going to have a lot of weight behind it. And it's a really good study. So we'll make that one available. And now we get to go on to an awesome conversation. Welcome to the Presentation Podcast. Hey, TED Talks and quality presentation, they're pretty much synonymous in my book here. And the TED stage is a big contributor to where the world of presentation is today, from both presentation skills and just awareness of what great presentation skills look like. We have the opportunity to talk with Jacqueline Farrington about, well, presenter recommendations and the preparation a TED Talk presenter goes through to provide the world with that polished professional and messages that deliver, as the tagline says, ideas worth spreading. So this is going to be a great conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Jacqueline, welcome to the Presentation Podcast. You know, that's where we talk about all things presentation and presentation we know has been in your world. One of the things we often say is that nobody plans for a career in the presentation world and that we all get here via different paths. You've had a long career in coaching others and speech coaching, but tell us a bit about your own path to where you are today.
Sure. And first, let me say thank you, Sandy, Nolan, and Troy. It is a pleasure to be here. And yes, I never expected when I was 15 and thinking about what I wanted to be when I grow up, I never expected that I would be here. In my 20s, I was a professional actress. And then while I was acting, I also started teaching at the Yale School of Drama, and I did that for about 14 years. And while I was there, I also started working with some students from the law school and the School of Management and realized that's really where my heart was, that I loved seeing the life impact that working on communication skills had for people other than actors. So I left Yale in 2005 to start my business, and I've been doing this ever since.
Well, that answers one of my questions. So 2005 was the start of speech coach, acting, coaching, I'm assuming, and all that other fun stuff?
No, not acting, coaching. When I left, I started working on presentations, but also personal impact. At the time, people really weren't talking about executive presence. And so we would talk about presence and personal impact. But then that grew into I took a job with another consulting firm that took me to London. And that in London, I started working with leaders on leadership development and executive coaching, organizational development, change management. So I really expanded my skill set when I was living in London. And so now, fast forward today, when I came back in 2012, I started this business that I have. And I really work at the intersection of leadership, change, and communications. So helping leaders deliver transformative change in their organizations.
Phenomenal.
And you know, a lot of executive and speech coaches do come from the theatrical world. You know, a lot of actors and acting coaches do that as well. You know, in addition to acting, it seems like an obvious path, I guess, or you know, background. How do you see your background as having helped that your current work?
So when I was at Yale, I went back to school and I got another master's degree in communications. Oh. Mm-hmm. And then that came out of working with some of the folks at the law school and the School of Management. But my practical work, I did the master's in London. So of course they call a thesis a dissertation. And my practical work towards my dissertation was looking at, can we actually improve and grow someone's self-esteem and confidence just through working on body language and the voice. And I wrote this program that I offered for free to the London School of Business and then also to Welfare to Work training programs in New York City. It took me 252, I know because I had to log them all, 252 phone calls to find a program, Welfare to Work training program in New York that would let me come in and work for free with their clients. But I ended up, so the London Business School became one of my first clients. And in New York, I ended up working with these 8 women who had never been in the workforce, who said they felt like society had just thrown them away, forgotten them, were terrified about going in for interviews, and worked with them for several months. It was life-altering both for them and for me. And it was then that I realized, hey, this is transformative. This can really impact people's lives. And so I still do draw on my acting background today, but it's now combined with all the other skills that I learned as I went through my career. But that was really the impetus.
That's amazing. So I'm going to pick up what Nolan just said, because Nolan, you said like it's an obvious path for people in theater stage direction to go into presenting. And the book itself is awesome because its title is The Non-Obvious Guide to Better Presentations, How to Present Like a Pro. And then I do really enjoy the fact that you very timely say virtually or in person. So book is amazing, everybody. It just released in March of this year. So didn't realize that when we actually set up this whole conversation, because we had this whole TED theme going and we're like, oh my gosh, well, we should reach out to Jacqueline and see if she's available. And then I get her book. I'm like, wait, this is like literally brand new, hot off the press. So thank you for joining us and congratulations on an amazing book.
Thank you.
I do have a question about it. So, you know, I can assume your years of TEDx experience and your background with at the Yale School of Drama, they provide plenty of insights, you know, for the book content. What was the inspiration for the direction or the focus of the book? Because I find it to be a great read, just nugget after nugget of good information. But how'd you decide on the format and the focus?
Well, the non-obvious guides are series of books. And I love that they say it's like sitting down to have coffee with an expert. And that stuck in my brain as I wrote it. I every chapter I thought, what would it be like to sit with someone and have a conversation about this topic? And in fact, part of the way I wrote it, I started it in the summer of 2020. And I would sit outside with my mom and my husband and make a batch of margaritas.
COVID project.
COVID project, exactly. Oh,
yes. And I would talk them through my ideas for each chapter and then I would record it so that I really captured the sense of having a conversation with someone. And so my thought for the book was, I want every chapter to feel like somebody's having a margarita with me. and getting some tidbits, some tools and ideas that they could immediately apply to become just even 1% better. You just take one tip, one tool, rather than reading it cover to cover, that they would say, hey, I've got this challenge, and then open chapter 7 that addresses that particular challenge. It's also, the non-obvious guides allow you to be a little irreverent. And in fact, that's how they're marketed, as slightly irreverent and as if you're sitting there talking to somebody who's very intelligent, not me, but the other person is very intelligent, not talking down to them. So while I was having those margaritas, I was able to have a little bit of fun with that irreverence. And I won't say more than that. You'd have to look at the book to get a sense of what that means. But yeah.
Well, I appreciate the fact that it's modular, that, as you pointed out, mm-hmm. that it's not a system. That's when I do my training, I always say up front, this is not a system. I'm going to fill your tool belt with tools that you can pull out as needed. And I think that sort of is clear. And also, I mean, I actually read the digital version. So those are great because you've got a table of contents, you can mm-hmm. skip around, you can keyword search, you can sort of get to, I need help with this and sort mm-hmm. of go right to it. But I'm glad you sort of explained the conversational aspect of writing it. So I'm going to ask you a question. So many people, myself included, tell speakers that they should think of public speaking as just having a conversation with an audience, or even imagine having a conversation with one person, even though you might be in a big auditorium. But at the very beginning of the book, you come right out and say that presenting is a performance, and that you need to think like an actor. So I'm going to admit that a lot of the time when I do say just have a conversation, there's a bit of manipulation going on in that, my intent is to reduce anxiety and nervousness, not say, hey, you're a performer now. But you come right out and tell people they're acting. And that can be kind of scary for people, especially, I imagine, lawyers and non-performers. Tell me just a bit more about that approach. I mean, you're very clear, like you're performing. So doesn't that increase the anxiety?
Sure, it can. And part of what a speaker needs to do is learn how to get the anxiety, the butterflies, if you will, flying in formation. And many of the tools in the book help you to get those butterflies to fly in formation. But it has to be a conversation, yes. And it also has to be a performance. So it's an elevated conversation. It's not a conversation like that you would have sitting around the dinner table after dinner, having a glass of wine, talking with your friends and family on a Friday night. It's not that kind of conversation. Audiences show up with expectations of you when you're speaking. They expect you to be prepared. They expect to be engaged. They expect sometimes to be entertained. Or they expect to be enlightened, to have ahas, insights as they're hearing you speak. So because of that, a presentation requires an elevated commitment from the speaker, elevated in terms of mental focus, mental engagement, elevated in terms of how you use your voice, and elevated in terms of how you use your body language. And I know here on this podcast, you talk a lot about visuals, and elevated in terms of the visuals that you bring into the experience. So it has to be prepared, it has to be focused, and it has to be intentional, strategic in terms of how you show up, how you communicate with that audience to help them hear your message.
I love how you call out to that point, the three C's. And I can totally see myself needing to address these. Let's see if I remember these. It's conviction. It's confidence. Maybe I'm not doing it in the right order. And what is the third? Wait, you can tell me what the third one is.
Connection.
Connection. Exactly. I always say, in order to be effective in your presenting, you need to connect with and compel the audience to act. And to do that, you need confidence to deliver the information. So, I mean, it was just spelled out so well. We were talking earlier, and I really believe this is going to be the holiday gift to a lot of my clients. I'm going to call out certain elements that you've outlined so nicely in your book. And the three C's is one of them.
So can I actually jump in on this just occurred to me, because my world is corporate presentations. We work with C-suite executives for their presentation. We design them. We're the backstage, you know, we're the technical side, but we're also the design side. And so I get to see this all, but you call out a presentation as a performance so clearly in such a good way. So a TED Talk, I think everybody, I'm going to ask your opinion. I assume that everybody comes to a TED Talk, they realize they're giving a performance. Whereas in the corporate world, I think most executives say, I'm giving a presentation. So I think this concept or construct of it's a performance is more of a mind shift there than TED. I think if somebody comes to any level, any structure of a TED event, they know they're giving a performance. That, you know, it's not just a presentation. They're on a stage to perform. Do you agree with that? Does it make sense?
Yeah, I think often when I'll ask a new client, why are you speaking? Why this message? Why now? And they'll say, well, to inform. I just need to inform. Okay, but why? Why do you need to inform? And that then gets to the crux of both conviction and connection, understanding why these words in this moment in time, right now, for this audience, which then starts to move it into the realm of performance. Because often when people think, well, I'm just here to inform, I'm just here to give them a bunch of information, download information. So just send it to them. If you don't know why you need to speak with them in this moment, have them read it. But if there's a reason for you to be speaking to this audience, then understand your why behind informing them. Because when we often, not always, but often when the only reason that we're speaking to an audience is to inform, we tend to throw everything in the kitchen sink at that audience. And we just give way too much information, just do a download. Well, that's how you're going to communicate in that moment, then send it to them. Let them read it. Let them digest it. They can't digest everything in the kitchen sink in one-to-one or one-to-many live communications.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm scrambling looking through the book because you have a statement that I highlighted so many call outs in this book. You had a great one about just too much content on a slide. You know, it's probably in your, so let me just rephrase that and say this, because it's probably in your chapter I want to talk about anyways. So we're a presentation podcast. We're obviously presentation designers. We obviously endorse using visuals, quality, good, not overloaded visuals. And you have a chapter dedicated to visuals. Now you talk about them throughout, but you have one chapter dedicated to it. And it's a pretty good lesson in one chapter about here's what I should be thinking of for my visuals in and of themselves. So I know on a TED stage or for any talk, it's not really required that you use presentation slides. And you know, presentation slides can be done well, they can be done poorly, but in your work with TEDx, because we made a comment in our last episode that as we're looking through past TED and TEDx or all TED conversations, it was actually fairly difficult to find ones that used slides or they actually showed the slides a lot. What percentage of presenters would you say use slides versus use no visual support? Visual support meaning like slides or pictures or something like that, not props.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think sometimes when people think about visuals, they only think about PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. And there are so many other ways to bring visuals into a presentation. But this is my completely unscientific survey.
Absolutely.
40% of TED speakers use some kind of visual. Well, no, let me rephrase that.
So less than half do not use slides.
Right. 40% use slides, I would say. And then there's probably 40% that use some other kind of visual. So I'm thinking Bill Gates,
mm-hmm. mosquito, right.
Around malaria and brings in the mosquitoes. And then the rest don't use anything.
Okay. I was curious about that. I really don't have a number to go with it, but seeing how you were entrenched in the, actually, you know what? really quick, let's take a step back. You worked with the TEDx Seattle. Is it called an organization? Because TEDx is a separate organization, right? It's, and the Seattle one was one of is one of the more prominent ones. I mean, there are a few TEDx events that have, you know, they have a high level of recognition. And I would say Seattle's right in there. There's a, and that's the one you were. And what was your official title with them?
Senior speaker coach.
See, folks, we didn't cover this. Now we all know this. We're talking about it. So senior speaker coach, and you were there for how many, several years? Roughly. Putting you on the spot.
4 or 5 years.
It's a lot of time. And they did at least 3 events per year, I'm guessing. I don't know Seattle TEDx.
Yeah, at least 2. So there's the TEDx, well, smaller events, but in terms of TED-like events, there's the main event. And then they also have TEDx Women.
Right. And their main events were at one of the larger facilities there. So you had several thousand people in the city. I mean, it was a big event.
Yes.
This wasn't a small TEDx event. This is a very established
3,000. Well, I shouldn't say it's usually about. It is. It's 3,000 people and it's sold out every year. Seattleites love their TED Talks.
It's very centric.
I want to, if you don't mind, I would like to hear more about how you worked with those presenters.
Sure. So it's a long process that everyone on the speaker team, there are writers and then there are delivery coaches. And everyone on the team participates in the process, meaning they read submissions the TED event is in November. Reading submissions starts in March. Or they're reaching out to leaders in the community, people who are doing interesting things, and reaching out and having conversations with them about coming in and speaking. So we all read the submissions, and then we also, as a team, work on the talks. And so usually it's end of March, mid-April that the speakers are chosen, and then they go through rewrites upon rewrites upon rewrites, really nailing down those talks with the whole team, commenting on them and coaching them through that. And then it's usually mid-August that delivery rehearsals begin for a mid-November event. So, and every speaker is different in terms of how much they rehearse. I had one speaker who rehearsed 80 hours.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. Now,
just a recap here.
For
a TED
for an
talk
18 minute
18
talk.
Minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's somebody who took it seriously or was maybe a little at a different nervous level, but that's that in and of itself is amazing. Or they were just absorbing the atmosphere. Like, I just want to be a part of this. But that's astounding in a great way.
There's such thing as over rehearsal. Well, I'm sure you would agree.
Actually, right? I love in the book how you talk about that.
Yeah.
Practicing a conversation versus over rehearsing, memorizing versus rehearsing. Really good call outs. Really, really great.
Thank you. Sorry.
I was going to say, of those who do use visuals, do you, and since you're sort of in this process from the beginning, what percentage sort of use somebody else to design their slides versus just doing it themselves?
TED or with corporate?
I would say, well, both.
Yeah. So at TED, we had an organization that designed slides for everyone, for those who were using them. In the corporate world, because I tend to work with very senior leaders, they usually have teams who
have people for that kind of thing
for them, but they're very involved with it. And so we're always having slide reviews. The designer is in every content meeting, delivery rehearsal, because a good designer, I know as the three of you know, they're listening for cues, for hints from the speaker in terms of, oh, you know what? This is an different emotional tone than I recognized just reading it on the page. So I think we need to tweak this slide because of that. Mm-hmm. So, but usually, yeah, it's teams that are designing that.
That's great.
And have you found yourself in situations where you tell people to get rid of the visuals or really they need to bring something in? I've been in situations where I'm like, you know what? Just black out the screen. Like, this is just get away from it.
Yes.
Especially in a TED talk, I think.
Yeah. So I find that happens if they are not well-designed slides and it becomes death by PowerPoint, meaning that they're reading. There's a bunch of bullet points on each slide, and they're just reading through each of those bullet points. And of course, the audience then is sitting there going, oh my God, he's on bullet point two, and there are 10 on this slide. And I've already read ahead. I already know where he's going, and I have to sit here and listen to him. So then, yes, I'll say, get rid of the slides. When the slides are more visual, as they should be, and I say in the book, one idea per slide, they can't read them. And then the visual is supporting what they're saying. So in that case, I don't see a point really in getting rid of the slides for a speaker if it's really supporting and adding. The slides need to be additive to what a speaker is saying rather than driving the performance, driving the presentation.
Absolutely. So, and I think you just said it, so, but let me have you maybe rephrase it or re-say it again. How do you personally summarize what makes a good presentation slide for the audience? So again, this is about the audience that's going to see it. As example, I often find myself saying to the presenter when we're designing it is, you know, the goal of good slides is to visually reinforce the main point or the key message at that point in your talk. It's to support the talk, not distract. You'll give the audience a distraction from you. Because you just had some great call outs here. What do you say to summarize what good visual, good presentation slides are?
Yeah, well, 100% what you just said. I'd add to that that the best slides create emotion.
Ooh.
And in fact, are slightly provocative. That they are images that really create that emotional environment for the audience and for the speaker, and support the emotional environment of what you're saying. So rather than, you know, you might have a message that is rooted in data, you're delivering some data, and you probably do have to bring up a data slide. Although if you look at what's happening out there now in terms of data visualization, that doesn't have to be boring either.
Right.
I worked for many years with Tableau software, and their data visualizations are stunning. So even data visualizations can be provocative, can evoke emotion. And but it's important if you do have a data slide that then before and after that, you have a more visual slide that evokes the emotional environment you're trying to create around that story.
It seems that you as the presentation presenter and those slides together, then they're what, when they evoke that emotion, that's the connection that happens with the audience. There's something in that image. There's something about how confident you are in delivering that image that the audience walks away getting it, being connected with you and the slide.
Yeah, if I could add to that, that it's, we love picture books. We love picture books from the time that we're little kids. We're fascinated with them. We're drawn into them, or they frighten us. And you look at the success and the popularity of animation recently, of what are they? They called the novels that are
graphic novels.
Yes.
If I go back and say that. If you look at the success and the popularity of animation right now and graphic novels, people are drawn into images. They pull us in. And so that's exactly right. It's doing that even with your visuals for a presentation.
Can you think of a moment from a presentation you saw or coached in which a visual really nailed it, or really was sort of one of those moments everybody thinks about, other than Bill Gates's mosquitoes?
Yes. Ava Holmes did a TED talk on sustainable fashion, and she had heartbreaking images of piles of tossed out clothing I think it was in India, I believe, and small children just standing there, this huge mountain of clothing that people had tossed off, and these two little kids sitting there picking through it. And then
I've seen it.
You've seen the talk?
Yeah.
And then she ended the talk with bringing out models who were wearing sustainable fashion. So you had that comparison and contrast between what is and what could be. It sparked our imaginations in terms of, hey, this is where I could be going with what I'm wearing. I could be making sustainable but fashionable choices. And I think was impactful because of that. But I could give you 10 more if you wanted 10 more.
Absolutely.
Well, we won't go on the spot, but it's like, no. What's an impactful financial slide you've seen? Let's not talk about that one.
No, let's not. But to that point.
But the same characteristics apply.
What's a bar chart you'll never forget? Those don't exist.
But that makes me think of corporate presentations. We've been talking about TED, and that's thrilling for me. But you've also worked a lot in the corporate America. What can each of these worlds learn from each other? Is there something that TED could improve on or borrow from the corporate world, vice versa?
Well, the first thing that pops into my head, Sandy, is with TED speakers, sometimes they get too caught up in the story, too caught up in the emotion, and they don't support it with evidence, support it with data. Mm-hmm. And which, of course, we do a lot in the corporate world. So that's one thing that they could borrow a little more. I think that the best TED Talks are very clear on what's the idea. In one sentence, what is the idea? And translate that into the corporate world. It may not be what's the one idea, but what's my one key message? When my audience walks out of here, what do I want them to either do, or what's the opinion I want them to form? What do I want them to think? Or how do I want them to feel? Because that's always crucial. So what's my one takeaway? And I think that's what the best TED Talks do. They're crystal clear on this is the idea. We often miss that in corporate presentations.
I'd certainly like to see more business presentations stop at the 18-minute mark.
Exactly.
You know, they're making them shorter now. Now it's about 12 minutes.
The TED Talks?
Yeah.
Well, you heard the last episode. There was a moment where we started comparing TikTok to TED Talks, and certainly people's attention spans keep getting smaller and smaller.
That's
so,
right.
That's where in a few years, TED Talk. Yeah, exactly. TED Talk will be.
There are so many interesting things laden throughout the book. One of them is the idea of brevity, just to kind of put that in there. But one of the sections that really caught my eye and I really liked, and I'm gonna ask you or challenge you about a different perspective on this. So the section is, and I'll put it in quotes here: 10 eye contact tips for your next virtual meeting or presentation. So obviously a lot of my work is in virtual. So everybody listening, you probably know that we handle a virtual meeting platform. We coach presenters. We are the ones behind the technology behind it. So usually something that's bigger than like a Zoom or Teams meeting. It's a more of a webinar environment.
Yeah.
So we're talking about presentation skills and you go through these 10 eye contact elements. But I have this new idea. I don't know. That's not the way to phrase this. I have this new perspective as the world has come back online that presenters now have two audiences. If it's an in-person meeting, they're talking to the room. But there is often a real-time remote audience watching. So it's a hybrid event in a true sense, presenter on stage with people in room, but the presenter has to acknowledge that audience, the remote audience as well, because sometimes they're actually the key stakeholders that couldn't be at the live event for reasons. So the 10 eye contact tips are phenomenal. If you're, so I know people can't see this, but we're looking at each other. We have a live camera feed so we can see each other. And you know, those are where those eye contact tips, which are phenomenal. They're probably the best written out segment arrangement of that information I've seen. But now there's this idea for presenters on stage. They need eye contact with the guests that aren't there. Do you agree? Or do you see that where corporate, especially in corporate, where corporate presentations are going?
It's situation specific.
Yes.
If you're giving a keynote to a large audience, a keynote address, let's say Amazon reInvent. And so you've got 10,000 people in the live audience and 250,000 people streaming, you don't need to think about it. Let the camera people do their work. And you just connect with the content, connect with the people in the room. However, if you're doing a presentation in a meeting, you have to be very intentional, and it's challenging. So there are two situations in that case. One is where you are live in the room with a live audience and you've got a virtual audience, but the other is when you are the speaker, but you are virtual, you've got a virtual audience, and then you also have a group that's in the room together. Really challenging and kind of exhausting, I have to say, having done those. And so it's important that you be very intentional with eye contact, number one. If you're in the room, it's tempting to make eye contact with people who are in the room with you. So you have to position yourself so that you can make eye contact with that camera and reach out to the people who are calling in virtual. You also have to build in breaks where you make sure you engage both audiences. That can be things like polls, quizzes, things like that, that get people engaged. If you are virtual and you've got virtual live, then again, you need to be really clear about engaging people. And one thing I recommend with that is to designate someone in the live room who can watch body language and then send you a chat message. Hey, Jacqueline, Troy is looking like he has a question. And then as a speaker, I can then engage with that. Mm-hmm. So you've got some eyes and ears on the ground, because sometimes you can't see those people in the room. They're just kind of faceless bodies.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many situational things. That's great, because I totally agree with everything there. On the last few meetings where we provide the tech package, so corporate meetings, 400 to 800 people in the audience, we actually take one of the front seats. We put a PTZ, a point-tilt zoom camera, and put it in place of a chair. So it's the same height. And we coach the presenter, say, here's your audience. This is your remote audience. There's three cameras around, but this one is specific to you. But that one also does exactly what you said. So I'm going to record this soundbite and show it to everybody. It has, it's a pivot. So it can pivot around and pick up the audience for the most part, especially the Q&A mics. We try and position them in line. There's always everybody that's an AV tech is like cringing, because the audience is a dark spot. It's hard for cameras to pick up, and lighting is coming from the back of the room. So now you're shining cameras into light. There's so many technical reasons why it doesn't work, but we've actually planted and said, this seat is your virtual audience. You know how you're told to pick out a presenter, an audience member, and talk to them for, 9 seconds. Then, well, this is one of the people you pick out, and you end up pulling in that eye contact. And you said something else there that I really wanted to talk about that was, you said a really great point.
They're all great points, I might add.
the idea of having a person in there to moderate. Thank you. Because it's this new, you brought up what we call the reverse hybrid. It's an in-person event, but the presenter is now the hybrid element. They're the remote person. And that's like a new evolution. It was very, very uncommon. Or if it was recorded message, you played back it, but now everybody expects it to be live. So it's this, we call it the reverse hybrid when we're setting up a meeting environment. But it's just a newer train of thought, because everybody's thinking, your book covers Zoom, Teams, WebEx, whatever, where everybody is kind of remote, but there's just this new dynamic. And I think presenters are really needing to be aware of it to make it work.
Very, very challenging. Very challenging. Yeah. And can I just add one thing to that, Troy, is make sure in both environments that you are talking with people, not talking at them.
Yes.
There's a temptation in that situation to start do what I call slinging content at people because you've got so much to think about. Your brain is on overload. So see if you can try to practice that hybrid environment before the day and remind yourself, this is a conversation. Even if I'm the only one talking, it's still a conversation. How are people responding to me? Oh, I see somebody's nodding their head, or I see somebody looks confused. So that I create that two-way conversation rather than just slinging words at someone. Like,
so important and so hard. I think in that reverse hybrid where the presenter is the remote element, I think it becomes even harder because everybody in the room is reacting to each other. They could even be reacting to the live feed, but that person remote doesn't see it. Okay, this is a whole nother topic, but it is a presentation topic and it's really exciting to talk about. Nolan or Sandy, take us somewhere else.
So there are mainly two parts of a presentation, right? There's the preparation and then the delivery, right? So, talking about those tools in your toolkit from the book, what would be the one section, if people could only go to it, that you feel is critical for presenters with regard to preparation? And then what one section you feel is critical for actually presenting in the delivery?
One section in their talk or one section?
Well, one section from your book. Okay. So let's talk about like the one tool. You can only give them two tools, one for, prep and one for delivery.
Okay, I can't remember the chapter number, but for prep,
I've got it open. Tell me what it is.
I think it's chapter seven, but
connection?
Okay. Maybe it's chapter 9 on rehearsal.
Oh, that's way up front. That's 4.
Oh,
and
is
I
it?
Loved it. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So cut all that. Cause I don't know what chapter.
You don't need the Home Depot aisle number on this one.
Aisle 4 talks about rehearsal and it is, I literally highlighted probably 2/3 of that chapter. It's like, I have this statement with slide design. People want to make everything bold. I'm like, when everything's bold, nothing is bold. Here's the problem with my book. When everything is highlighted, nothing is highlighted. And chapter 4 on rehearsal is literally one of those segments. So that's awesome. You call that out.
Yeah, that would be for someone who wants a down and dirty rundown of what to do to prepare, read the chapter on rehearsal. And then for delivery would be chapter 1. And that we've talked a little bit about that today. That's on presence. That's on connection, confidence, conviction, and also strategic presence. Meaning strategic presence is about how you need to show up in order for this audience to hear this message. And that may be slightly different than how you habitually show up, what your default presence is. And so thinking about, do I need to be more of an extrovert in this situation, or do I need to be more of an introvert and take a step back, ask more questions, listen? So I would say chapter 1 for delivery.
I love that strategic presence. It's more, you talk a lot about how you can prepare, whether it's makeup or clothing or your background. But that's all strategic. You have to think about it and be mindful of how you are going to show up. I think it's wonderful. And that makes me think of, and maybe this is a repeat, but I may word it a different way. We can bring it back to TED, or it can be the corporate presentation. Let's say I have 3 minutes. Not me. I'm not going to do this. It's typical of many presenters. You have 3 minutes to coach me. What must I do? What should I focus on most in order to have a successful talk?
So you're like standing at the base of the backstage saying, okay, here's the information you need.
Oh, you got called up. I got called up at the last minute. And
that never happens. Yep. Sandy, where are you? No, corporate America never happens.
Never.
Right. Never.
Three things. One, is get clear on your take-home message in one sentence and take it one step further than one sentence. Use the discipline of writing it in 7 words or less, like a newspaper headline. So you're crystal clear on why you're showing up there.
Okay.
To walk away from. And then the second thing is be clear on your strategic presence, how you need to show up. And a quick way to do this, and I love this exercise, it's a focusing exercise as well. I use this when I go in between meetings. Choose 3 adjectives for how you need to show up. It might be dynamic, passionate, calm, or it might be adventurous, energetic, and clear, whatever those 3 adjectives are. And then it's a 10 breath exercise. I won't take you through all of that right now, but what you do is close your eyes and think about low, slow breaths. So really letting your breath drop down, slowing down the breath, and you, on the first 3 breaths, you focus on the first adjective and you create this film in your mind's eye of seeing yourself, feeling yourself doing this, being this. I am energetic. I am energetic, repeating silently to yourself. And then the next three breaths, the second adjective, and then the final adjective. And then on your last few breaths, it doesn't have to be 10 breaths. I usually just talk the client through 10 breaths, but it can be as many as you want. But on your last few breaths, focusing on all three breaths. And then open your eyes and start to go into your presentation. So that's a really nice way to just quickly check in with your presence.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. It really is. I am thrilled that you are here.
I said there were three things and I can't remember what.
You did say three things.
I said take home message, the three
breathe.
Adjectives.
And then the breathe.
Okay. Let me just add, can I just add to that?
And the bonus one is.
Yeah. And then can I just quickly add? And the third thing is blow out some breath right before you walk on stage. Don't take a breath, but blow out some breath. So blowing out some breath will relax all of your muscles in your body. And when our muscles tense, our brain also tenses. It tends to freeze up. And so blow out some, it kicks in the autonomic nervous system because that's what the breath is a part of. We have to breathe without thinking about it. So when you get rid of the breath, the body goes, oh, hello, I need some breath. And you start to automatically breathe because people often hold their breath when they go out on stage. And this is something you see athletes do. You see runners right before the big race, they're blowing out some breath.
Fabulous. Thank you. I'm ready. I'm ready to go on stage.
We have had a great time conversing with Jacqueline. Thank you so much. Without any sponsorship, I can personally say Jacqueline's new book from the Non-Obvious Guide series, Better Presentations, How to Present Like a Pro, is a great resource for presenters with just so many great ideas and so many, I can almost say, not so practical tips because they're not the ones you always hear. They are phenomenal. They'll help everyone at every level of presenting, or especially moderating panels and co-presenting. First book I've seen with a really, really good section on that because I deal with those all the time. I will be referencing that one quite often in events. So to bring this full circle back to TED Talks, wow, was the Seattle TEDx events fortunate to have Jacqueline on their team. We are so happy to have some of those stories and experiences here as part of the podcast. Thank you. Before we close out this episode, we do a bit of a more kind of fun pro and tech tip session. Jacqueline, are you okay to stay with us for a few more minutes?
Love to.
Okay, let's jump over to pro and tech tips.
Okay, well, I'll get us started. What I'm about to suggest is one might construe as being an agenda slide. But I want to take it a little bit on a different angle from what we typically present when we pitch our creative. A client has asked us to build a template. They've asked us to build a presentation. And you go away and you come back and you have to make sure that they like it. And what I've learned along the way is that I need to create expectations before I start my pitch. I've probably already done that when we kicked off the presentation, the communication along the way. But before I start my pitch, I create a what to expect slide. For a template, for example, I might show, and I have this in the show notes. I don't know if we can share it on the website at all, Troy. But for example, I had a wedding planner, of all things. And she had actually concerned me because I was watching her interact with her web team. And I thought, I'm going to have a really hard time selling this to her because she really doesn't know what to expect. So I outlined for her and very graphically, I showed her a thumbnail of the title slide on her what to expect in draft one. I showed her a couple of agenda slide options, a section slide option, a content slide option, and a handout option. These are on what might be construed as an agenda. But visually, her breath was taken away because she got to see the big picture before I dove into details. It worked really, really well. By the end of it, she actually added budget to my project because she was so impressed.
Sandy, just to confirm, to make sure I got this in my head, I have two questions. One, I see you put two example images.
Yes.
Can I put those in the show notes for everybody to see?
Absolutely, you can.
Okay, I will do that. They'll be on the webpage, so anybody wants to go to the show notes. And two, just to make sure I'm clear, so this is your what to expect slide to the client. Here's what you're going to expect I'm going to do to your redesign. This isn't for the audience to see. This
no.
is like not a,
I'm pitching it to my client. I don't want them to be... You know, you have to create expectations in order to sell them on a new idea. And what it does is it lowers any defensiveness, like, oh, I didn't do it right in the first place. You're telling me I didn't do it right? I'm kind of just guiding them along the way to a better approach.
Nolan, we could have made this a whole conversation.
Well, this is Sandy's presentation to her client.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is client management, which I love it, actually.
This is my pro and tech tip, the what to expect. Yep.
Yeah, definitely we should share those because those are cool to see. All right. Well, I'm gonna stick with a presentation design PowerPoint tip as well. Jacqueline, we often do like barbecue tool tips and things like that. It doesn't have to be, but today we're sticking to what we do. So this is sort of very basic, but it's how I avoid using Command Z or Control Z. So that's undo. And it's like the most important command, like everybody knows and learns and uses, but I use it really rarely in PowerPoint. And I certainly, like, every once in a while I'll do like one or two.
Because you're that good, Nolan. No mistakes ever. Just go forward.
Well, no, here's why. I never do it more than like, you know, three, four, or five. Like, I don't get into that. Like, how many undos do I have? Because I was doing it the other day and I found myself doing like eight or nine undos. And I'm like, what am I doing? I never do this because I forgot to do something. Whenever I'm designing something and I look at a slide or something, I'm like, you know what, something's not right here. Let me try something else. The very first thing I do is Control D or Command D, which is duplicate the slide. And I think PowerPoint is one of the easiest programs to work with in this way. Like this really hard to do in general in Illustrator or InDesign or PowerPoint. Like it's not that easy to just create a new artboard or create a new document and try something out. But in PowerPoint, all you do, Command D, and then try whatever you're trying. And often I'll get to, you know, okay, I did 50 different actions and this and this, and that's terrible. Delete. And I'm back to the original. And that's it. I don't have to worry about undos. I don't have to worry about like backing out to what I had. Just duplicate it 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. Try something else. And then whenever you have whatever you want, just delete the other. So it's like a very fundamental, basic workflow. But it's one I forgot about the other day when I was doing. So just think about that. Duplicating a slide costs you nothing. And it is so easy to do to just try something else and then just delete it when you don't like it. So
good one. Very
good.
That
is my workflow tip for the day.
I feel guilty because I have a PowerPoint related topic and we always usually have these random stuff. So Jacqueline,
no,
don't feel
good.
Put
We're
on the
brand
spot.
Today.
I really think that last one is because Nolan is always the forward guy because he likes to delete things. Yeah, go away instead of undo, which he's actually, you know, we're TLC Creative Services for the upcoming presentation summit. We're sponsoring the t-shirts and I'm thinking this through our workflow because obviously it was Adobe Illustrator art we turned over for the printing, but we did the initial design work in PowerPoint because it's just faster. It's a great design layout tool. And Lori and I were just coming up with all these different slogans and different layouts for, you know, arranging the multiple logos of our company and this and that. And then we moved it over to Illustrator. And it's funny you say you can't add artboards easier because it was easier for us just to drag stuff off to the side of the artboard. So yeah, we had the artboard in Illustrator, but then we had like this ring of stuff around it with all these other ideas we didn't want to get rid of until the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so I just last week, so when this drops, the week prior, I had two blog posts that were on, so this is a PowerPoint formatting tip. We're all PowerPoint this week for the most part. I had two blog posts about keeping text inside a shape versus stacking a text box on top of a shape.
Yes.
Because it's very top of mind. I'm doing presentation makeovers by the dozens of slides and a few presenters, it just makes it so much more ridiculous. You know, they have a circle, which was one of the blog posts, and they stacked a shape on top of it because they couldn't make the words fit inside it because PowerPoint's defaults don't help you. You also don't know how to work with them. But then they just had rectangles with a text box on top of it. So they were highlighting their text with a box underneath it and then alignment. And, oh, it just became, it's just so tedious. So, you know, I'm going in and basically fixing it for them. Presenters will never, you know, it's just a, you're just,
you put it into the shape, right? When you're fixing it. Yes. Okay.
And it's just a bad workflow. There are a few instances, triangles would be a good example, where you stack it on top. So anyways, my tip is if you have a shape and you have text, just click on it and type the text inside it. It makes formatting so much easier. And it is, and if you're one of the people in the background going, well, of course, trust me, there are so many people that don't think that way. And it's just, another one was, it's a centered headline. The title slide title is centered. Well, they want them left justified. So they literally nudge the text boxes over to make the text left aligned visually. So it was visually left aligned, but it was a formatting nightmare as I'm looking at the 19 slides. Luckily, there's only 19 on this particular one. And I'm like, I've got to, anyways, going on. So my tip is keep text inside of the shape whenever possible. Jacqueline, enlighten us. And this could be a promo for your amazing book. It could be anything, but we'd love to just get little outside tips that have nothing to do with our conversation in many times.
Well, I'm going to give a tip that is a follow-on to your conversation. Ooh. And because so I'm going to stick with the theme of PowerPoint. And I've mentioned throughout our talk that it's really important in a presentation to headline your talk. What's your takeaway message? Another thing that I do with clients is have them quickly go through your deck one slide at a time and headline each slide. What's the take-home message on that one slide? Even if you have a slide that is content-rich, one message per slide. And I'll make them do it really fast and do it several times. So that's a way of just starting to internalize their message, and then also get clear and crisp on their message as well. Because often they'll want to, you know, go into, well, this slide is about blah, 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 with a lot of words. Nope. One headline per slide. Yeah. My book is on all major booksellers, and I can be reached on LinkedIn, Jacqueline Farrington, or at the website farringtonpartners.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been so fun, so enlightening.
Thank you. It's really fun.
This is Troy from TLC Creative Services, a professional presentation design studio. Check us out at tlccreative.com. VXPmeeting.com is our solution for live events that need a professional destination for the remote attendees. And my blog, thepowerpointblog.com. It's got PowerPoint presentation tips, tricks, and inspiration, and I'm just having a ton of fun with it.
This is Nolan from Nolan Hames Creative. Check out nolanhamescreative.com. That's where you can learn more about our presentation and data viz training and get some free downloads on the goodie page. And of course, if you want to design slides without bullet points, which we should all be trying to do, check out thebetterdeckdeck.com. There you can get the actual deck of cards, the PDF version, and even the PowerPoint source files to save you even more time. And podcast listeners, just use the code PODCAST to get a discount on any order.
And this is Sandy Johnson with Presentation Whiz. You can visit my website and blog at presentationwhiz.biz. I'm also on LinkedIn as Sandra Johnson, PowerPoint MVP, and on X as at PPTWiz. Also, don't forget about the Presentation Guild. You'll find everything you need to know about that organization at presentationguild.org.
This has been a great presentation conversation with so much inspiration throughout it. Links to Jacqueline's book and more are in the show notes, which are available on the Presentation Podcast website, thepresentationpodcast.com. The Presentation Podcast is produced by TLC Creative Services, Inc., and new episodes release on the first and third Tuesday of each month.